The older man who participated in the meeting with Ekström on Saturday is Georg Nyström, a police superintendent, Figueroa said as she put the surveillance photographs from Modig's mobile on Edlinth's desk.
Superintendent, Edlinth muttered.
Stefan identified him last night. He went to the apartment on Artillerygarten.
What do we know about him?
He comes from the regular police and has worked for SIS since 1983. Since 1996, he's been serving as an investigator with his own area of responsibility. He does internal checks and examines cases that SIS has completed.
Okay.
Since Saturday morning, six persons of interest have been to the building. Besides Sandberg and Nyström, Clinton is definitely operating from there. This morning he was taken by ambulance to have dialysis.
Who are the other three?
A man named Otto Hallberg. He was in SIS in the 80s, but he's actually connected to the Defence General Staff. He works for the Navy and the Military Intelligence Service.
I see. Why am I not surprised?
Figueroa laid down one more photograph. This man we haven't identified yet. He went to lunch with Hallberg. We'll have to see if we can get a better picture when he goes home tonight, but the most interesting one is this man. She laid another photograph on the desk.
I recognize him,
Edklinth said. His name is Wadenschuh.
Precisely. He worked on the terrorist detail around 15 years ago. A desk man. He was one of the candidates for the post of top boss here at the firm. I don't know what became of him.
He resigned in 1991. Guess who he had lunch with an hour or so ago? She put her last photograph on the desk. Chief of Secretariat Schenke and Chief of Budget Gustav Atterbom. I want to have surveillance on these gentlemen around the clock. I want to know exactly who they meet.
That's not practical, Edklinth said. I have only 4 men available.
Edklinth pinched his lower lip as he thought. Then he looked up at Figueroa.
We need more people, he said. Do you think you could reach Inspector Boblansky discreetly and ask him if he might like to have dinner with me today, around 7, say?
Edklinth then reached for his phone and dialed a number from memory.
Hello, Armansky. It's Edklinth. Might I reciprocate for that wonderful dinner? No, I insist. Shall we say 7?
Sannander has spent the night in Kronoberg prison in a 7-by-13-foot cell. The furnishings were pretty basic, but she had fallen asleep within minutes of the key being turned in the lock. Early on Monday morning she was up and obediently doing the stretching exercises prescribed for her by the physical therapist at Sahlgrenska. Breakfast was then brought to her, and she sat on her cot and stared into space. At 9:30 she was led to an interrogation cell at the end of the hall. The guard was a short, bald old man with a round face and horn-rimmed glasses. He was polite and cheerful. Giannini greeted her affectionately. Sallander ignored Faster. She was meeting Prosecutor Ekström for the first time, and she spent the next half hour sitting on a chair, staring stonily at a spot on the wall just above Ekström's head. She said nothing, and she did not move a muscle. At 10, Ekström broke off the fruitless interrogation. He was annoyed not to be able to get the slightest response out of her. He began to feel uncertain as he observed the thin, doll-like young woman. How was it possible that she could have beaten up those two thugs, Lundin and Niemann, in Stalleholmen? Would the court really believe that story, even if he did have convincing evidence? Sallander was brought a simple lunch at noon and spent the next hour solving equations in her head. She focused on an area of spherical astronomy from a book she had read 2 years earlier. At 2:30 she was led back to the interrogation cell. This time her guard was a young woman. Sallander sat on a chair in the empty cell and pondered a particularly intricate equation. After 10 minutes the door opened.
"Hello, Lisbeth,"
a friendly tone. It was Teleborian. He smiled at her, and she froze. The components of the equation she had constructed in the air before her came tumbling to the ground. She could hear the numbers and mathematical symbols bouncing and clattering as if they had physical form. Teleborian stood still for a minute and looked at her before he sat down on the other side of the table. She continued to stare at the same spot on the wall. After a while she met his eyes.
"I'm sorry that you've ended up in this situation," Teleborian said. "I'm going to try to help you in every way I can. I hope we can establish some level of mutual trust."
Sallander examined every inch of him. the dishevelled hair, the goatee, the little gap between his front teeth, the thin lips, the brand-new brown jacket, the shirt open at the neck. She listened to his smooth and treacherously friendly voice.
"I also hope that I can be of more help to you than the last time we met."
He placed a small notebook and pen on the table. Salander lowered her eyes and looked at the pen. It was a pointed, silver-coloured tube. Risk assessment. She suppressed an impulse to reach out and grab the pen. Her eyes sought the little finger of his left hand. She saw a faint white mark where 15 years earlier she had sunk in her teeth and locked her jaws so hard that she almost bit his finger off. It had taken 3 guards to hold her down and prize open her jaw.
"Always a scared little girl, barely into my teens then. Now I'm a grown woman. I can kill you whenever I want."
Again she fixed her eyes on the spot on the wall and gathered up the scattered numbers and symbols and began to reassemble the equation. Teleborian studied Salander with a neutral expression. He had not become an internationally respected psychiatrist for nothing. He had a gift for reading emotions and moods. He could sense a cold shadow passing through the room and interpreted this as a sign that the patient felt fear and shame beneath her imperturbable exterior. He assumed that she was reacting to his presence and was pleased that her attitude towards him had not changed over the years.
"She's going to hang herself in court."
Berger's final act at SMP was to write a memo to the staff. She was angry, and she filled 2 pages explaining why she was resigning, including her opinion of various colleagues. Then she deleted the whole text and started again, in a calmer tone. She did not refer to Fredrickson. If she had, all interest would have focused on him, and her real reasons would be drowned out by the sensation a case of sexual harassment would inevitably cause. She gave 2 reasons. The principal one was that she had met implacable resistance from management to her proposal that managers and owners should reduce their salaries and bonuses, which meant that she would have had to start her tenure at SMP with damaging cutbacks in staff. This was not only a breach of the promise she had been given when she accepted the job, but it would undercut her every attempt to bring about long-term change in order to strengthen the newspaper. The second reason she gave was the revelation about Borkshue. She wrote that she had been instructed to cover up the story, and this flew in the face of all she believed to be her job. It meant that she had no choice but to resign her position as editor. She concluded by saying that SMP's dire situation was not a personnel problem, but a management problem. She read through the memo, corrected the typos, and emailed it to all the paper's employees. She sent a copy to Pressens Tidning, a media journal, and also to the trade magazine Journalisten. Then she packed away her laptop and went to see Holm at his desk.
"Goodbye," she said.
"Goodbye, Berger. It was hellish working with you."
They smiled at each other.
"One last thing," she said.
"Tell me."
"Frisk has been working on a story I commissioned."
"Right, and nobody has any idea what it's about."
"Give him some support. He's come a long way, and I'll be staying in touch with him. Let him finish the job. I guarantee you'll be pleased with the result."
He looked wary. Then he nodded. They did not shake hands. She left her card key on his desk and took the elevator down to the garage. She parked her BMW near the Millennium offices at a little after 4:00.